Well, good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. Sorry, we're starting just a couple minutes late, though that clock is a little fast. So glad to be with everybody. We will start, as usual, by having the clerk take the roll. Ms. Khan, if you can please do that.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Present.
Lee Daniels.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Present.
Representative Hansen is excused. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Present.
Representative Hicks.
Present.
Representative Hudson.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watoon. Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Perez Vega.
Present.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Khan. And so asking Vice Chair Keeler, if you can, to move approval of the minutes of our meeting from February 2nd.
So moved.
Thank you. And so any additions or corrections, members, to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of our minutes from the February 2nd meeting, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. That motion passes. So members, here is the plan for the week. So today we're going to hear a report from the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force, and I'll provide just a little more context to that as well in a second. But our meeting today will be a little bit shorter, I'm expecting, than usual. This is just the only item on the agenda. Part of the reason for that is that we will be convening tomorrow in a joint session with the Committee on Education Finance to receive a report from the Office of Legislative Auditor about oversight for state grants, and so we'll have that. That's at 11 a.m. tomorrow. I'll apologize that I know members have, some members have conflicting committees, et cetera. There's sort of no way to do this because education finance is a different slot than we do, but it did seem to me to be important enough that we be able to hear that report with that committee, since portions of the report have to do with the Department of Education, which is an agency we've oversight over. And so members may need to juggle a few things, and we can just kind of figure that out. So that'll be 11 a.m. tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll be hearing bills on that talk about some investments in early care and learning that, in my mind, really build on the work of this task force. So that's kind of the arc for the week. Just want to see if there are any questions that anybody has about the agenda for the day or week. So not seeing any. Okay. Let me think. So members, in the 2021 session, the Republican Senate and the then DFL House put a proposal together and advanced a proposal that to establish the task force we're about to hear the report from. And I should note that the context for this is really recognizing how broken our early care and learning system is. And so the task force was charged with accomplishing three goals that I think we're going to hear about. I just really want to focus on, I think we're going to hear a little bit about the context for those goals. Really what I think the report is going to focus on is kind of what we do about those three goals. But the extent members have questions about kind of what even led to it in the first place, we'll get to that in the discussion. So with that, I think we are ready to begin with our presentation. So glad to have the three of you. I think maybe that Benny Moses is going to go first. And please, if you could identify yourself, share your preferred pronouns if you're comfortable with that, and then please proceed with the presentation. We'll go from there.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. We're honored to be here today. I am Jenny Moses, a program director for the Children's Cabinet, she, her, hers. The Children's Cabinet housed within the Minnesota Management and Budget refers to the convening of the state's commissioners around children and youth. Our team leads this interagency effort and has been charged by the governor and lieutenant governor with helping make Minnesota the best place for each and every child to grow up. Per statute, MMB was charged with providing staff and administrative services for the Great Start for All Minnesota Task Force, Children Task Force. The task force was proposed by early care and education advocates and legislators and signed into law in 2021 by Governor Walz. The legislation establishing the task force had bipartisan support. The statute required one representative of the Children's Cabinet to be a task force voting member. I served in that role and as one of the three co-chairs, along with Sandy Simar, who is here with me today, and Shakira Bradshaw. Sandy will introduce herself in just a moment, but Shakira was unable to join us today. She served in a parent role on the task force, as she has two children in the Early Care and Education, or ECE, system. The task force statute was preceded by language making it the goal of the state for all families to have access to affordable, high-quality early care and education that enriches, nurtures, and supports children and their families. The statute states the goals will be achieved by the three sub-goals displayed here: creating a system in which family costs for early care and education are affordable, ensuring that a child's access to high-quality early care and education is not determined by the child's race, family income, or zip code, and ensuring that Minnesota's early childhood educators are qualified, diverse, supported, and equitably compensated regardless of setting. The task force was established to develop strategies to meet these goals. This work was centered on developing a long-term vision for the state. The implementation timeline was directed to begin in July 2025 and finish no later than July 2031. Though we were directed to offer a plan starting in 2025, we did discuss the importance of addressing these issues as soon as possible. Immediate action and investment is needed. Legislation directed the task force to meet monthly starting in November of 2021 with a draft report due in December of 2022. We submitted our final report to legislative chairs with jurisdiction over early childhood programs and the governor on our deadline last Wednesday, February 1st. Per statute, our task force had 15 voting members and 22 non-voting members, representing many aspects of diverse voices in the early care and education system in Minnesota. Per statute, voting members included legislators, center directors, licensed family child care providers, school, center, and Head Start-based educators, and a member of a federally recognized tribe. Though all members of the task force were able to shape recommendations, voting members were tasked with approving them for inclusion in our final report with a simple majority vote. Non-voting members shown here included representatives of advocacy and business organizations, as well as state agency employees. To address the aspects of the ECE system required by the establishing legislation, task force members, staff, and facilitators held 15 meetings as a full group. Evening virtual meetings allowed for participation from across the state, including providers who cannot participate during regular business hours. We had two working groups that met 9 times each to work more in depth on recommendations in the areas of affordability and workforce compensation. These working groups were optional to join and consisted of both voting and non-voting members. They worked between February and October of last year to do extra research, analysis, and recommendation development for consideration by the full task force. We engaged in office hours and surveys between meetings, reviewed existing reports, materials, and recommendations. There were 4 listening sessions held with the public, hosted by the co-chairs, and we drafted, revised, and voted to approve recommendations for inclusion in the final report. When we started our work together, we also found common ground in a few essential commitments that were approved by voting members. Identifying historically disenfranchised groups who have not experienced equity in the ECE system, which you can see listed on this slide. The group agreed to center equity throughout their process of developing recommendations. Formal acknowledgement of a commitment to a mixed delivery system, recognizing that all types of providers and settings provide value to families and children, and family preference must be honored and respected by design, as well as acknowledgement that care and education cannot be separated. Though the establishing statute did not address the fiscal impact of the legislative charge and it was not within the scope of our work, the task force recognized that the recommendations would have significant financial implications. To fully understand these implications, the task force recommended a fiscal study of each budget-related recommendation, a comprehensive economic impact assessment of the long-term recommendation, which would consider child and family outcomes, economic impacts, including potential savings and costs to taxpayers, and a strategic financing study to identify and assess the impact of revenue options available and ways to maximize existing funding streams to cover the costs of the long-term plan. I'll turn it over to Sandy to review some key recommendations included in our report.
Thank you so much, Jenny Moses. And members, I just do want to point out that we have a full copy of the report here. There's a lot there. I think I may have sort of horrified the staff and wanted to have all that printed out, but it felt important enough to our work and hopefully will be guiding us over the coming weeks that you have that in your packets, and I really urge you to take a look. Sandy Simar, if you can please proceed, identify yourself, preferred pronouns if you're comfortable, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members. My name is Sandy Simar, and I'm a Head Start educator at Families First in Rochester and a co-chair of the task force. I'll now go over some of the key long and short-term recommendations included in our report, but as Chair Pinto mentioned, encourage everyone to consult the full report for a comprehensive picture. In discussing affordability, one of the areas of our legislative charge, we know that though some settings for ECE or early childhood education are publicly funded, including some school-based settings and Head Start, and public dollars that provide assistance in affording care to low-income families, the ECE system is largely a private market. Private businesses in this field face a unique set of constraints on their costs and revenues, such as required group sizes and adult-to-child ratios for health, safety, and development, which lead to limited options for reducing the cost of providing care and education. Parents who need care during the earliest years of their child's life are often at the beginning of their careers and have limited spending power, so are spending high percentages of their family budget on ECE. The high costs of providing ECE services cannot be met by parents and families. For example, if a family in Isanti County has one infant and one preschooler enrolled in a child care center, the median rate they would pay per year is $22,516. If they choose a family child care setting at the median rate, they would pay $16,640. If that same family had a college-age student attending the University of Minnesota, they would pay $16,108 per year in tuition and fees.
Sandy Summer, can I just pause you for a second on that comparison? So and then how many children per room for an infant or preschooler versus how many average, you may not know the second part, but maybe I'll pause on that. How many children are sort of allowed in an infant or preschool classroom?
Under licensing, seven are allowed in center-based settings for infants, and I believe it's 14 for toddlers. And then preschoolers, it's up to 20.
Okay, and then just, I guess, a gut sense would be we probably could have 30, 60, 90, a couple hundred when you come to a college classroom. Mm-hmm. So just thinking about the economics there. Okay, yeah, no wonder. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. As this committee has heard about in previous hearings, we ask families to pay the most when they have the least. And this leads to early childhood educators effectively subsidizing rates for parents through low wages, leaves businesses operating on a shaky foundation, and leaves working families with impossible decisions to afford their basic needs. Federal and state-funded public work support programs like food and child care assistance often supplement many ECE workers' wages through public benefits designed for low-wage workers. ECE workers' wages are lower than those of workers in other fields with the same education. And the profession is not seen by many as a viable career, given low wages and lack of opportunity for advancement. The U.S. Department of Labor would not approve ECE as a field for the dual training pipeline program, apprenticeship program, as they required occupations that paid a higher wage. And job counselors do not generally direct people to ECE as a field for job training and education due to low wages and lack of career advancement opportunities. As a result, the childcare marketplace has not been able to meet the access needs of families. So the first recommendation here is transformational. To create a family benefit system that provides affordable access to early care and education for all families with an affordability standard of no more than 7% of income for all families. This would dramatically expand affordability of early care and education programs through a new Great Start Minnesota program. This new program would blend existing federal and state funding streams along with additional funding needed to fully support the program. Under the proposed program, all families are eligible with the maximum payment lining up with the 7% of income affordability standard, which we were directed by legislation to establish. The 7% affordability standard aligns with federal recommendations, and the task force recommendation means that through this benefits program and program funding that is calculated based on the true cost of care, families would pay no more than 7% of their income for early care and education services. For higher income families, this would still likely mean paying for the full cost of services, since for some families, 7% of their income does cover the full cost. The contribution scale laid out in the report lines up with the bipartisan federal proposals. The second bucket of recommendations included is the area of program affordability. We recommend that the state provide early childhood programs with adequate funding to deliver effective services for children and families. We ask that the state equitably fund providers for the services they offer. Minnesota should pay programs based on the true costs of services rather than market rates, which are used today for benefits programs. Current rates are limited by the prices families are able to pay, rather than a rate that would cover the full cost of care and allow for fair workforce compensation.
I might, Summer, I might just call members' attention back to, I think it was several weeks ago when Aaron Sojourner, the economist, was in. I remember that he had a chart showing the cost of providing licensed care, the cost of providing high quality care, and then the amount that families could afford to pay, even at significantly higher than 7%, is actually quite a bit less than the cost. It's just a sector that just doesn't work. And so this acknowledging that. Thank you.
Thank you. Here you can see some of the short-term family affordability recommendations coming out of the task force. As you will see, the task force recognized the need to build on and invest in the system we have while moving toward the transformational Great Start program. Again, this is not a comprehensive picture of the report, but a few recommendations to highlight include expanding eligibility for the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, and early learning scholarships. This includes the following short-term recommendations for CCAP. Expand eligibility to 85% of the state median income and by increasing eligible activities. Increase hours covered to ensure continuity of care. Reduce family co-payments for CCAP and make permanent the reprioritization of basic slide fee CCAP waitlist. And for early learning scholarships, to increase scholarship funding to cover the full cost of care, expand scholarship age eligibility to include birth to three, expand priority populations for scholarships to include families with a caregiver in a substance use treatment, families experiencing domestic violence, families with an incarcerated caregiver, and families with a caregiver in a mental health treatment program. We also produce recommendations for simplifying the administration system of current benefits program, including by having effective electronic systems that can be updated, having one billing and tracking system for both programs, and making income eligibility guidelines consistently based on one metric, the percentage of state median income. Here you can see some of our thinking on affordability for early care and education programs. The task force identified that the state should work toward a future system where funding is stable. That includes funding based on enrollment rather than attendance and in advance of services rather than reimbursed after the fact. Funding should exist through per child rates and base operational funding amounts. The funding process is transparent. Cost modeling should be clearly communicated along with policies and procedures. That administration is simple and consistent, that funding should be blended and braided behind the scenes with one payment system and one administrative agency for providers. And paperwork should be simple and electronic processing should be available. And that there is accountability for the use of funding, that clear publicly available expectations for use of funding with family choice prioritized. That funding is equitably accessible across all settings. That includes flexibility and honoring differences in provider types. Pages 22 through 32 of our report addresses these affordability issues and recommendations in more detail. I'll now move on to our next buckets of recommendations, accessibility and effectiveness. We were asked to develop a plan that could ensure that a child's access to high-quality ECE is not determined by the child's race, family income, or zip code. In discussing accessibility, the task force identified six factors that must be considered to develop an equitably accessible plan, including flexible availability pertaining to schedule and hours, and greater accessibility pertaining to geography and location of early care and education that meets the diversity of families' needs. And the role local communities should have in both determining access priorities for their communities and how to meet access needs. That resources and availability of providers to offer culturally responsive programming and environments. That transportation and other barriers, such as language barriers, affecting access to families' programs of choice. Accessibility and ease of the process through which parents determine eligibility, identify options, and secure early care and education. Also including income and other eligibility requirements that lead to public subsidy access for early care and education. Those last two factors are connected to the family affordability recommendations we already shared, so we focused our access recommendations on the first four factors. You can find our full set of accessibility recommendations on pages 33 through 38 of that report, but here are a few examples. To conduct a study of other programs that have successfully invested in incubation, startup, and expansion to identify appropriate infrastructure and funding mechanisms. To support and expand the state's efforts around program navigation for families, to provide community planning funding and support in all regions. And to conduct family focus groups to better understand some of the specific systemic barriers they face by community. This could start through existing networks of advocates and support organizations. And some examples of the barriers are ensuring language barriers are inclusive of ASL or hearing impairments, accessing care regardless of immigration status, accessing care if you don't have access to health care, and caregivers who are not legal guardians, how they can access and advocate for kids in their care. We discussed the concept of effective programs as encompassing high quality. We discussed an effective experience for children and families that include addressing and advancing social, emotional, psychological, cultural, physical, and intellectual needs of each child in a trauma-informed manner. Providing safe, stable, secure, consistent, nurturing, and enriching environments for each child. Building trusting relationships founded on mutual respect between each family and their caregivers. Promoting linguistically responsive and culturally relevant environments with a diverse workforce that reflects the families they serve and the whole state. And connecting families to resources and supports they have identified will increase their family well-being. To enable the early care and education workforce to make the task force vision of effectiveness a reality for all children and families, Minnesota needs consistent and equitable standards and growth-oriented accountability systems, a healthy business environment and clear, consistently applied regulations, and a cohesive, high-functioning infrastructure and ecosystem, fair compensation and supports for the ECE workforce, and more consistent and equitable funding, which enables many of the above. Those last two factors are connected to the program affordability and workforce compensation recommendations, so we focused our effectiveness recommendations on the first three factors. You can find more context in our full set of effectiveness recommendations on pages 39 through 42 of the report, but here are a few examples. Endorsement of the ongoing continuous improvement efforts for Parent Aware, including the Racial Equity Action Plan and the Parent Aware Equity Report, and the ongoing child care regulation modernization projects. to continue existing business trainings and resources, to study infrastructure needs and programmatic changes, to create a new and centralized governance structure with adequate funding and resources, and enhanced coordination and consolidation, taking into account interactions between the ECE system and the business community, the broader state workforce, the broader early childhood system and programs, and issues that affect Minnesota's families. And to complete an analysis in partnership with a diverse stakeholder body, inclusive of providers of all types, of the option to include all licensed programs and family child care providers in Parent Aware, Minnesota's Quality Rating and Improvement System, the QRIS. I'll now pass it back to Jenny to share more about our workforce compensation and supports proposals.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll go back to Jenny Moses. And members, we shouldn't be too much longer, and we're going to get, and so folks have clarifying questions as I've been bringing up, you can do that, but otherwise, and then we'll have a full discussion. So, Jenny Moses, back to you.
Thank you. Establishing legislation asks that the task force develop a plan to ensure that Minnesota's ECE educators are qualified, diverse, supported, and equitably compensated regardless of setting, and specifically asks that we include a compensation framework that supports recruitment and retention of qualified workforce in every setting, and set compensation for early childhood educators by reference to compensation for elementary school teachers. I served on the Task Force Workforce Compensation and Supports Working Group, which did in-depth research and analysis on these issues to present back to the full task force. We know that trusting relationships between consistent caregivers and children are essential to creating positive early childhood experiences. This requires a stable workforce with low turnover, but today's compensation structure forces teachers, assistants, and other early childhood education personnel to leave the field to find livable wages. It leads to persistent workforce shortages and the inability to recruit new employees. Overcoming this foundational challenge requires investing in wage growth to attract, retain, and support Minnesota's ECE workforce. This becomes especially important with the ongoing shortage of workers in Minnesota, resulting in a tight labor market that has led ECE workers to pursue better paying roles. We need ECE workers to increase capacity and meet demands for childcare. In short, we can't solve the state's workforce challenges without solving the ECE-specific workforce challenges. Despite statewide efforts to improve access to early care and education programs in higher education, there are few incentives for the existing workforce to further their education, given the low wages and lack of room for career advancement in the field. There are also cost and accessibility barriers associated with enrolling in advancing credentialing or degrees that deter many individuals from enrolling, especially those from our most historically disenfranchised communities. We developed recommendations in each of the areas of our legislative charge on this matter, addressing qualifications, diversity, support, and equitable compensation. You can find those on pages 44 to 54 of the report, and I'll go over some of them now. Our long-term compensation framework is made up of a base wage and a recommended wage scale, and we also have recommendations around benefits. We landed at the idea of a recommended base wage in line with the deed cost of living wage for an individual. In 2021 numbers, about $16 an hour. Our proposal is that programs be able to opt in to compensation funding provided by the state to allow them to pay all employees at least at that level, which we believe is appropriate for an entry-level role. To get early educators to a level closer to parity with elementary educators, we developed a wage scale based on one published by deed in 2020. The idea here is that programs will be incentivized through funding to pay in alignment with education and experience. This would need to be incorporated into the cost modeling efforts we recommend as program funding provided through the new family benefits program. We also have recommendations around a process for determining comparable competencies and experience for the purpose of the wage scale. The highest level on the wage scale gets to parity with elementary teachers for a lead educator in birth to five settings. Here are some of our short-term recommendations to improve workforce compensation and supports: expanding the Grow Your Own program and Minnesota transfer pathways, creating regional substitute pools and conducting a workforce study, continue and expand programs for mental health supports, short-term financial relief efforts like bonuses for training and education, and compensation grants. Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee, for time to share the task force process and recommendations. I will turn it over to Stephanie Hokanson, who will share how the governor's budget aligns with task force recommendations.
Thank you so much. Yes, so what I'm inclined to do is to finish up these slides, and then we'll move to questions and discussion. Ms. Hokanson, we've received a presentation on the governor's budget proposal before, so I'll ask you to go through these slides pretty quickly. I know there's a lot of words here, and members, make sure that you're reading along, but Ms. Hokanson, if you can just give us a quick orientation as to how they align with the task force report, and identify yourself and then proceed.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Hokanson, and I'm the policy director with the Children's Cabinet. I use she, her pronouns. Thank you first to the task force co-chairs and members for their dedication and work on the task force. As you can tell, it was a robust timeline and a lot of work presented before you. And thank you for taking the time to listen and dig into their recommendations. I do want to take a few minutes, but I'll go pretty quickly to illustrate how the administration is really digging into the task force recommendations, understanding the urgent need for investment in the ECE system that will benefit our state's economy and working families and their children. Many of the governor's budget proposals are aligned with recommendations of the task force, and most of those recommendations are within your committee's purview, but not all. And you've received a presentation on specifics, so I won't go into too much detail. To support family affordability, the governor's budget proposals that align with the task force recommendations include a significant expansion of the Minnesota Child and Dependent Care Credit to provide economic relief for low and middle-income families, investments in the Child Care Assistance Program, including a $15 million per year increase to serve more families, expanding eligibility to foster and kinship families, as well as permanent reprioritization of the basic sliding fee wait list. Investments in early learning scholarships include more than doubling the base to by investing $90 million more per year to serve an estimated additional 9,000 children, expanding eligibility to birth to age 5, prioritizing 0 to 3-year-olds, and adding children of incarcerated parents to the priority list. And then additionally, at MDE is establishing a forecasted full-day pre-K program that would be mixed delivery, serving 4-year-old children through a model comprised of school-based Head Start, licensed center, and licensed family child care programs that would add an estimated 13,000 slots by 2027. In the areas of program funding, the governor's budget proposes to increase CCAP rates to the 75th percentile of market rate study. Additionally, would invest resources in a number of other areas listed here and support benefits access for all workers in the state through the paid family medical leave program and health care options. In the areas of accessibility, the governor has proposed creating an Office of Child Care and Community Partnerships at DEED and expanding the DEED Child Care and Economic Development grant programs, expanding and creating sustainable funding for the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development program at MDH, and then an array of family navigation supports, including community resource centers, full-service community schools, and school-based health centers, as well as supporting ongoing ARPA-funded initiatives that support capacity building, business training, and workforce supports, which the names are listed in the slides. In the areas of effectiveness, the governor's budget streamlines licensing and application and renewal processes for family child care providers, and as you heard a brief presentation on a couple weeks ago, proposes a new Department of Children, Youth, and Families that consolidates child and youth programs at MDE and DHS, as well as small components at MDH and DPS. But one of the strong components of that proposal is to consolidate early childhood programs into one place to better coordinate and align those programs and systems. And so with that, that concludes
swiftly,
our presentation.
Swiftly and efficiently done. I think we're all grateful and to all of you for your work. And I just want to note at the start that it's incredible the amount of effort that's gone into this. I was looking for the report and just really appreciate it, and especially grateful for the four legislators who served on the task force, none of whom were on this committee, as it turns out, though all of whom are still in the legislature. Now Senator Bolden, Representative Bennett, who's in our body, Senator Housley, and Senator Wicklund. And so the good thing is that even though they're not on our committee, that means we have more champions other places in the legislature, which is terrific. So members, I think we are all set then for questions, comments, maybe a little more questions because we're really trying to get information from these folks, but anything that anybody has. So let's see if anybody does have anything. Representative Hudson, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to kind of think out loud and maybe a question will fall out and that you can respond to. So as I am reviewing the executive summary here, on page 2, on points 2 and 3, there's reference to funding. And there's a language used that talks about, it kind of juxtaposes this concept of true costs against market rates, which I think we could fairly say is just price. In fact, it goes on to say market rates, which are used today for benefit programs, only reflect the price families are able to pay. And yeah, that's how price works. I wouldn't be driving a 10-year-old vehicle if I could afford a brand new one. Those price signals serve a valuable economic function. They tell producers that they need to produce more or less. They tell consumers that they need to consume more or less. And if we remove or push our thumb on one end of those scales, it can create a scenario where there's disruptions in the supply chain, so to speak. And so I guess my concern is that the kind of the big picture vision for this new department and this new approach to early childhood education, and, you know, there's other references in here in your list of recommendations, particularly when it comes to things like the amount of money that parents are paying, and the compensation for workers using terms like living wage and whatnot. It all seems to be summarized by the idea of whatever people need, people should get. Parents and children need early childhood education, so they should get it. The workers in these environments, whether they're child care centers or family childhood or family providers, they need compensation, so they should get it, without regard to defining what that need is and considering where it's going to come from. In fact, in the list of stakeholders here on the first page of the approved recommendations, I noticed the conspicuous absence of taxpayers. And so I guess if I'm going to phrase this in the form of a question, it would be, is there any, what's the functional limit that we see in terms of what constitutes early childhood education and how much we're going to ask current and future taxpayers to put into this new department that we're creating?
And I'll say, I feel like this maybe kicks off a really good series of issues and questions and things. So we'll go to the testifiers, and I suspect maybe members will have want to engage on that as well. I'm not sure which, if any, of the testifiers wants to respond, or they maybe I don't think this you've identified a really deep question, and I should probably note too that in a way you all were given a charge to do a certain thing, so sort of I might think, Representative Hudson, in a way the charge they were given sort of assumed the answer to your question to a certain extent. So if you can answer that, that's great, and it may be that we as legislator, or I as one of the people involved in writing this, maybe needs to respond to you as well, Representative Hudson. But let's see, if you're comfortable responding, please do, but I do know you were given a charge. You kind of had to just take it, but yeah, Jenny Moses, please.
Sure. Thanks, Chair Pinto and Representative Hudson. Yes, the task force was charged to create recommendations and an implementation timeline. As you've mentioned, we looked at previous reports and looked at other what other states are doing. Market rates are used in Minnesota. What we are looking at from other states and have explored as a task force is really identifying the true cost of care, because what we continue to see and hear, and Chair Pinto mentioned this himself in the presentation you had from Aaron Sojourner at the University of Minnesota, what it truly costs to provide care in Minnesota is not what families are charged. And I think that's a hard juxtaposition to hold when we hear about how much care costs in Minnesota. And how much families are paying. We were not charged in, to identify like how much we would pay for these things, who would pay for these things. When we were looking at those opportunities, we did create that recommendation to do a financial study and to think about what the economic impacts would be, and many of the members recommended that we look at what some of those benefits and costs would be. That they, we do believe that by providing some of these opportunities to children and families, that we would actually remove costs from other areas of government. And so I do just also want to say, as far as the makeup of the task force, you know, we are all taxpayers ourselves, most of us here in Minnesota, and we worked really hard to come to consensus around all of these recommendations.
And maybe Representative Hudson, I'll, as the person who one of the people who wrote this and sort of gave them the charge, mm-hmm. I'll note that I think that the thing is, under, you know, classic economic theory, so education is something that has massive positive externalities, right? I can't think of a form of education around the world that doesn't have, where there's not, where it's simply for profit. You know, even think about the vouchers proposed on the GOP side, it's still public dollars that are going to support education. So the idea is that this is a public good that has positive externalities. And so that's where market rates on their own, if you just would imagine we provided no public support to education at all, education, K-12 education would be super expensive for families, would pay horrible wages to the people who do the work. You know, it would not have the benefits it has for our society. So we decided as a society, it's a public good with such positive externalities that we're going to intervene in that, in what would be otherwise a market. So just to sort of respond to you in the economic theory point, so this is early education. Actually, the science says it's actually more important. I mean, if anything, you'd kind of say, well, if we had to choose between 0 to 4 and high school, actually 0 to 4 is at least as important, if not more important. I don't see anybody proposing not having public funding for high school or saying, oh, families just figure out what they do entirely on their own. We do have public support. So that's the thinking, is that there are positive externalities. We require a 0% contribution for families once their kids turn 5. And so the thinking is that, you know, 7% seems actually pretty reasonable, and it makes sense that we wouldn't just set the cost based on what families can pay, because we don't do that for education or for other public goods, is the thinking. So, and I'll return back to you, sir, if you want to continue with that. Representative Hudson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all of that context in terms of economic theory, because that really is what I'm speaking to, is
understood.
Economic theory. And, you know, we don't want to go down that rabbit hole too deeply here in committee today, but I'll just say that it does concern me when we remove price as a mechanism for determining where we should be making our investments, both individually and communally. Because what price does, you know, I don't know. My kids love bananas, right? I don't know the first thing about how they're grown or how to cultivate them or how to transport them from where they're grown to here in Minnesota. But a lot of other people know the things that they need to know in order to deliver that product to me. And price is the only information I need in order to make my decisions when it comes to that product or other products and services in the market. And when we eliminate or interfere with price signals, it throws a wrench in the gears of that process of being able to kind of reconcile all of the inputs and all of the needs and all of the considerations. And so what we end up doing sometimes is by blinding ourselves to the things that we don't know but that price conveys, we end up having to come up with new ways to get that information. And it creates kind of an unnecessary bureaucracy to determine something that was determined automatically just through the function of price. And so all that to say, that my hope is that as we move forward with this work, that we'll look for opportunities to leverage that market process to ensure that parents and children are getting the service that they need and the service that they want that reflects their values. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Yeah, let's bring some more voices into the conversation. Representative Lee, we'll call on you and then a few other folks. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I just want to thank all of our witnesses for testifying today. I want to make sure that folks, you know, listening at home and folks here also understand that Democrats also have a very, very good idea of economics. And I want us to back up a little bit. Obviously, don't want to go into a rabbit hole, but I want to make sure folks understand that there is a shared understanding in economics that there is frequently market failure. And we see that in our care economy, where you know, we know prices don't reflect the true value of goods and services in an economy. And so that means that we don't pay our child care providers enough, we don't pay our teachers enough. And so we because we know that there is market failure, right, the government subsidizes things that have positive externalities, because we know that that is a value to society. There are also negative externalities for certain things. And you know, this is also where we try to hold polluters accountable, right? And so I want to make sure that when we talk about price, it's very clear that sometimes prices in the market are accurate and sometimes they're not. And I think the proposal before us, right, is trying to make sure that, you know, we are properly compensating, you know, for some of the goods and services that we find valuable in the community. And I know this is really, really wonky, but the key takeaway.
I love economic theory. Right? I'm loving this. Keep going, Representative Lee.
The key takeaway is that right now, you know, our care providers, right, are not being compensated. There's market failure. And any economist will tell you that's true in our economies. And this is why we subsidize corporations all the time. This is why during the pandemic we put out PPP loans to make sure that the economy runs. So there is frequently intervention in our economy. And as legislators, we think it's really important to invest in our youngest constituents at a really early age so that they don't come back and cost our criminal justice system more later down the road. And also so that these little people grow up to become valuable members of our community, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. So I want to close with that because I know I've been taking up a lot of time, but thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Hicks, you're up next.
So I am not an economist. I'm just a mom who can do grocery store math. So grocery store math tells me that in my district, the median child care costs for an infant and a toddler is $36,000 a year. That's the middle. We have 50% higher, 50% less. So in Olmsted County, it's $36,000 a year. Now, grocery store mom math tells me that if I have a two-parent household and both of those parents make $21 an hour, one is a PCA at the Mayo Clinic and one is a phlebotomist at the Mayo Clinic, that they bring home $80,000 a year, $86,000, give or take. And grocery store math tells me that if 46% of their take-home salary ends up paying for childcare, one of those people is leaving the market. They're leaving employment because their net gain after they pay child care costs is $4,000 a year. So I'm not an economist. I'm not fancy. I'm just a mom who knows that if it costs me 50% of what we bring home to put my children in daycare and we have two parents working, it makes more sense to stay home. And in the workforce shortage that we are experiencing in this state, I don't know how that makes sense for our larger community as well. So I know that's slightly a different take of sort of the other conversations that are happening, but if we need people in our workforce, making it impossible for them to be in the workforce because childcare is more than their wages or more than half of a family's take-home wages, that doesn't work. And that's just grocery store math. But I think if we put money into childcare, we will help in other sectors and save money in other places as well. So I just wanted to share that because families in my community cannot afford care, even when they're in vital fields that we need.
And Representative Hicks, that even assumes that somebody can stay home, can afford to stay home, which many families.
Well, that just assumes a two-family household, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. Okay, Representative Zalesnikar is up next. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. You know, my
piece is, regardless of who is paying it, the costs are a critical factor, but we are talking about fully funding costs and the public good. And when I look at society, we're not doing that in assisted living. We're not fully funding costs there. I don't believe we're fully funding costs in, we have situations with sheriffs and police. My concern is how are we going to determine, and I don't know what this medium wage is for ECFE, for greater Minnesota, metro areas, and then what is the, all those salaries in the trajectory for education from birth to, you know, high school to post-secondary. What does that whole grid look like? That's not my lane. So that's my first question. In why I'm asking that is that we're also asking people to do shift work, weekends, holidays, run operations 365 days a year. And the model is not there. So whether the dollar comes from private pay money, businesses, or government, we're all paying for the services that we need, whatever it is. There is no magic money tree in the backyard. You know, taxpayers pay the government. And so whatever programs we come up with for seniors, for adults, or for children is paid by somebody, which is all of us in this room. So I just want to make sure we understand the model we're looking at, that it's sustainable. And so that's, you know, that's the piece I'm looking at, is what is the, you know, what is the median, you know, do you have data that talks about that? Because I don't know that lane. I know healthcare, and I know there's a lot of gaps in assisted living and that lane. And I think the seniors are important too, and I think children are important. But we have a lot of tough decisions to make with one pot of money. And so I just want to understand it, if you could explain that piece.
Yeah, let's see. Stephanie Hogan, it looks like you're prepared. Well, we're going to see who's, yeah.
Representative Chair, I'll start, and I might have Jenny add in some of the comments.
And Leah, let's make sure, pull it. I just want to make sure being recorded properly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, please. Yep.
Okay, I hope that's better. So first, I'll say the median wage for ECE workers in the state is the lowest median wage for anyone with a high school diploma, essentially, and it's about where a job requires a high school diploma, and it's around $12 an hour currently. And the task force recommendations, as Chair Pinto referenced, the task force was charged with developing a compensation framework within kind of the requirements of the statute. And I will say, I think the last time I was in this committee, I referenced kind of the similarities between the healthcare system and the affordability standard and modifications we've made to the healthcare system. Obviously, those systems aren't exact in the services they provide or the economics of them, but I appreciate the comparison when we're trying to create an affordability standard for families at 7% while recognizing the costs of the services that are going to be provided under that standard. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the market here needs the charge of the task force was to figure out what that cost modeling could look like. Other states are doing that, and that cost modeling would take into account other aspects of the market, which are what is the typical rent, what is the geographic differences of that, what are the needs for kind of the goods and services that child care programs have to provide, food, etc., and then what are the compensation requirements, needs of the workforce. And as we mentioned in our talking points, a starting point was around $16 an hour, and right now employers in the ECE system are only required, of course, to meet state and federal laws regarding minimum wage. So I might pause, and
I just wanted to add, I guess, when you, if I understood you right, you were saying that that's the median, the 12 to 16 for early childhood educators, and then going to the, was it, I don't know if it was lowest or highest, it was referencing the kindergarten teacher. So for the kindergarten teacher, what is the median wage right now in Minnesota?
Ms. Hogenson or Ms. Moses, I'm guessing, Ms. Moses.
Sure. Thank
you. A heck of a lot higher than that, I know.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Pinto and Representative. I will direct folks to pages 50 and 51 of their report, which provides our wage scale, which at the top, so the lead educator in a 0 to 5 setting, that 30.31 an hour provides parity with the elementary
school. About double.
And just to clarify, the median wage for early educators is around $12. We are proposing that a base wage would start at $16.
Okay. Representative Zalesnikar?
It's just my question in the context. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And maybe just as I turn to other members, Representative Zalesnikar, you made a comment. You said there's no magic money tree. And I guess I just want to say there is a magic money tree. Like, it actually exists. This is it. 13% ROI. There's just so much research. So, I mean, it's like, actually, like, this is the payoff. And it's funny, this is like the biggest, most high impact investment we can make, and we pay the people who do it the worst. So it actually, I mean, there actually is a magic money tree. It's this is it, right? I mean, it's not right now, of course, it's over time, but because we didn't make the investments 20 years ago, here's where we are now. Reverend Zalesnikar, please, yeah.
And I appreciate what you're saying. I guess my reference point is the money tree is if there is a return on investment with education, but if there isn't parity between wages between like entities, assisted livings won't have people to care. So then there's another vacuum hole created. Assisted living and nursing homes won't have CNAs. They won't have like people to provide care for seniors when we have the fastest growing population. So that creates another transferred increased cost somewhere else. So in a big picture economic level, you have return on investment in one way and costs going through the roof in another area because the cost of care for that section is very high. So that was the piece I just wanted to reference.
Thank you. I mean, one of the reasons CNAs are not coming to work is because of child care, because they get squeezed. We know surveys that the child care is a huge problem. This is the workforce behind the workforce. It's got kind of the double impact, right? It's the ROI in the long run for kids. And in the meantime, it keeps parents coming to work at assisted living. Representative Lesnar.
And I don't. Has anybody in here been a CNA or worked in the assisted living nursing home? Yeah. So there's a big piece of it too. And I guess my second question for the child care side, and to your point on, is what degree are we looking at regulations? The cost of the regulations. Costs for both care groups comes from a lot of regulations, and that's been my world for 30 years. So there is. If we're going to look at that, in any report, we fairly have to look at what regulations can we not have in place that takes teachers away from teaching, early childhood caregivers away from caring for children at those critical points, and when I've been visiting sites in the last 2 weeks, I'm hearing from them, there's a lot of unnecessary paperwork, a lot of compliance that doesn't make sense. And I think we have a responsibility to ask both questions, not just where we're increasing funding, but where are we getting rid of some of the huge strangleholds that are not leading to good outcomes for children or seniors in the whole scheme. And we keep adding regulations and mandates, whether it's size and scope. We don't give the people the ability to use independent critical thinking. And I think that comes with the respect in the profession, too.
Representative Katiza Witun is up. And I've got a couple more members who are. Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for all the work that you guys are doing in this area. It's really nice to see such a big stack of information and recommendations for us to really consider going forward. There's a couple things I want to piggyback off of, I guess, Mr. Chair. First, in terms of, and I think that Representative Zalesnikar made a really good point about how, you know, the money does come from somewhere. Taxpayers pay the government. Representative Hudson mentioned that taxpayers are not listed on the list here, but we're all taxpayers. I mean, so children, obviously, like, aren't paying taxes, but their families are paying taxes. Programs and providers are paying taxes. Our workforce members are paying taxes. Businesses, employers are paying taxes. I don't think that we don't have to separate the taxpayer, the Minnesota taxpayer, out as like a separate stakeholder because we're not just one group. I mean, you're not just a taxpayer. You participate in some other way in our economy, in the world of early childhood education.
in some way or another. And so I think that that's really important to consider, that we all, you know, see from multiple different lenses. So I wanted to, you know, point that out, and I think that Representative Zalesnikar kind of made the same point, that the money does come from somewhere and how we participate. One thing I also wanted to ask, and this is setting a floor for the market. Is that correct?
Let's see, Ms. Simar or Ms. Moses?
The wage scale, or
it looks at Representative like, Ratoon, to clarify your question, if you can.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess I can. Yeah, I'll go a little bit further. I mean, so what, yeah, whether it's wages, whether it's offerings, I mean, we want to make sure that every child has access to high quality, affordable care on this level. But it's not like limiting the market. It's not limiting providers from, you know, say offering and charging more for organic program grown food in the back garden of the child care center, or offering Spanish instruction, or STEM teaching, or I mean, like these program providers could go above and beyond this, and then like the price could vary, right? I mean, so like if somebody's offering like way above and beyond, they can charge accordingly. That's my question.
Ms. Moses.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative. Yes, so what we were asked to set, so programs, yes, could charge more for the programs that they're offering, but we were asked to set an affordability standard for families, which would be no more than 7%.
Representative Kazizwatoon.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful, because I mean, I do think that that's an important consideration, that you know, families in seeking out what is important to them, we want to make sure that everybody has access to similar programming, and that it's affordable, and that it's available to them in their area. But if people want to pay more, if they want to, you know, request specific things, if they want to seek out things that basically help their family in a way that another program may not, and they have the funds to pay for that, then they may choose to do so. So I think the price and the, you know, some of the economic drivers, I think that that still plays into the market. It's not, you know, washing away all the other options and opportunity that folks have. I did just want to touch on kind of the wages as well. And I want to make sure that we're not pitting different groups of Minnesotans against each other. And I think, you know, Representative Zalesnikar, I really appreciate her background in terms of long-term care in that area. And we serve on the Human Services Finance Committee, so I know that you bring a wealth of information. And I think that that's really beneficial to kind of ground us on, you know, on Minnesotans in one side of life, and here we get to have these conversations about Minnesotans at the very beginning of life. But I do think, I mean, I was going to make the point, Mr. Chair, as well as the return on our investment. And I think, you know, some studies are as low as every dollar goes into early childhood education, you can get eight times investment. I've seen some studies as high as 16% return on investment. And, you know, to that point, wherever the money comes from, wherever we're able to subsidize, you know, CEOs who are making millions of dollars, if they're contributing back into this system, they're going to get that money back in a well-educated workforce, in safe communities, in et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it just goes on and on. I mean, you pull one trigger and it has impacts, positive impacts, to Representative Lee's point. And I just think that that's really something that we need to consider, because otherwise, people who are making $12 trying to educate and care for our children in this stage of life, and PCAs who are trying to care for our seniors in their need, are going to go and just be delivery drivers who are making $25 an hour. And I don't think that, you know, it just it's we have to consider all of these pieces, and I think that starting here at the beginning of life and making sure that these systems are working well to set folks up for the next stage is really what this is all about. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Coulter, you're up next.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back, I think it was Representative Zalesnikar who mentioned, raised the question of regulations, and I agree. I want some of the earliest work I did in my previous job, actually working for a member of this very task force, was on sort of one of the precursors to this task force. It was the somewhat awkwardly named Legislative Task Force on Access to Affordable Child Care. But one of the things we heard over and over again from providers were the challenges that they have with the regulations and coming from 87 different counties and all of that. And I guess I would just sort of, first of all, say that it is, by the way, I forgot to say thank you for your work on all of this. In as much as a 95-page report can be a page-turner, this is one. I'm about halfway through it, but it's excellent. But it does specifically discuss some of these very challenges, and I think it's pages 39 to 43, according to the slides here, that talk about these very issues. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, we've had some sort of initial conversations, and there will be more to come about our fiduciary responsibility, our responsibility to provide oversight. And I think we need to be clear that these are different sides of the same equation. When we say we want to provide oversight, often that results in more regulation. When we say we want to make sure that folks are doing the things that public dollars are supposed to be doing, that requires regulation. And so I think, you know, there is always that tricky balance, but I think we just need to be clear about where these regulations come from. And I'm not going to go too far into sort of reiterating things that other folks have said, but I mean, I think it's just worth pointing out that investing in our youngest learners is one of the best ways to make money. I mean, shoot, if I could get an 8 to 13 to 16% rate of return on a stock, I'd be a lot more well off than I am now. And, you know, we talk about this as if it's only the upfront costs. And one of the things, and those of you who are on other committees with me, higher education, property taxes, and so on, one of the themes that I've kind of notice with a lot of things is it's pay me now or pay me later. And you know, there are costs to doing this up front, but they're a heck of a lot lower than the costs that come from the work that Representative Pinto does as a prosecutor, from the work that we see in other departments and other needs down the line, that if we're investing in our youngest Minnesotans, those costs aren't realized. And I would just return again to a point that was made in one of the early presentations that we had here, that we spend less than a fifth comparatively on our youngest learners than we do on folks who are in our K-12 system. And we know that the development that happens from 0 to 5 is in many ways much more important and much more serious and has much greater long-term effects. So I think, you know, we need to think about the full equation when it comes to costs. And I guess the final point I would make is, you know, I completely agree that the free market is, on the whole, a force for good. I think there are a lot of things that the free market can do that, try as we might, government just can't. But that rests on the presumption that the market is free. And if there's one thing that we've seen in this presentation and in, I would argue, just about every presentation we've had on these issues, it's that this market is broken. It is not working for anyone involved in this equation. And that's where we need to step in and address these issues. Because otherwise, I mean, we know what the outcomes are. So. I'm looking forward to finishing the report. I'm on page, I think, 55, so I'm like, I got like 40 to go. But I am looking forward to doing this work because I think regardless of where we are at in life, we all interact with this system. Even if you're not a parent, you work with a parent, you work for a parent, you hire a parent, you engage in commerce with a parent in some way. And these issues matter immensely. I'm going to say it again, ability to care for our kids is the greatest economic issue that we face in this state, and I would argue maybe in this country today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Hemmings and Yeager, you're up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for this presentation. I really appreciate, as a scientist, I've been struggling to try to grasp all of the things and put it in together, that to something that makes sense. So I really appreciate how you've taken something that has been very messy to me and kind of put it in a way that has clearly identified where we're lacking, clearly identified gaps. And as I was looking through the slides too, we're already working on some of these things, which I think is very exciting. And I just kind of want to offer my experience. You know, I know that my family was very fortunate growing up, but that doesn't mean it was easy. My mom was in the healthcare sector, and she quit her job about 30-some years ago when my sister was born because she was paying more in daycare than she, like, she was literally paying a dollar more an hour in daycare, I believe, than they were bringing home as an income. So that's one person out of the healthcare market. Luckily, she was able to come back, but that's kind of neither here nor there. A great friend of mine, brilliant scientist, left the workforce because it was too expensive to send her kids to school. Science, research, laboratory, like there's another person that we're missing that gap. And when I think about this, who are the ones leaving the workforce? Who are the same pool of people that are mainly responsible for caring for the kids at home, mainly responsible for childcare workforce, mainly responsible for the healthcare workforce? It's the same pool of people. It's women, it's lower income, it's people in, you know, BIPOC communities. So by taking out one, we're really having drastic downstream effects. And there are really great workers at the state agencies that are also families, that are also balancing childcare, that are wondering, should I just quit my job so I can, you know, stay home, take care of my kids, and maybe save some money? They're working in these agencies and they have the same ideas and they say, we need to make this more efficient. We need to make this better for my daycare provider who's down the street. We need to make this easier for me. And that is why I, you know, really promoted that we need to also think about how we can invest in these systems, because I know agencies have the same ideas. They want things to be efficient. They want less paperwork. They want to decrease the burden. So, you know, bringing all these things together, I think we now kind of have a clear path on like where we can make these investments, where we can make these decisions so that we can really solve this problem. Because it was happening 30 some years ago when my mom left the workforce. We haven't done anything to keep it up to date and to progress it. And so now we have this opportunity and we have a path, and I'm excited to do some work. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson Yeager. So we have two repeat signups. I'm going to go to them. I'm just going to ask them to keep it pretty quick if they can before I go to Lee Daniels. Representative Lesnikar, we'll go to you, and then Representative Hicks.
Thank you for the report today, too. You know, when I look at, in the report, it talks about equity and ensuring everyone has what they need to be successful. And then it also talks about those at risk or with developmental delays, which would be for all in Minnesota. And so when I look at that, it really, that language is equally for the students that are in school, the elementary students, because we all know that there's gaps in the education system right now from out of school learning. We're at proficiency rates that are not even 50%. So that's, when I look at education, that is tragic, and I come from an educator. So this is, you know, then I look at, is the per pupil funding equal? It's not equal. So what you get in Moorhead isn't the same as you get in Proctor, isn't the same as you get in, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul. So are we going to have equitable, is equity going to come across to per pupil funding for the entire education thing, to your point of return on investment? Because education is not just 0 to 5. It's continual, to my understanding. So that does not appear equitable to me when we look at that. So I just bring that as a reference point as we have total discussions how that's going to look for the state, because we have a gap in that needs to be plugged the hole to get people to a 50% proficiency in critical areas of science, math, reading. And if that's not going to happen, all Minnesota students are going to lose. And so, and to the another point is just to say, some people are I have half my family and friends who have chose to be stay-at-home parents. They didn't leave the workforce. They chose that. They want to do that. They want to raise their children, and they're not in the workforce, and I respect that equally. So we can't make the assumption that every single person that could work is going to choose to work, and that is their choice that I 100% respect. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesnikar. And so we actually have with three repeat signups. So we're going to go to Representative Hudson after Representative Hicks. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you again for being here. And I'm so excited to hear that folks want to fully fund education and support people's decisions about how they want to raise their family. That's so exciting. And totally on board as well. Like, I completely agree. But one of the conversations we haven't had is that we have a demographic math problem in Minnesota. We have folks aging out of the workforce, and we don't have as many folks coming in. And we can cut this pie a million different ways, but at the end of the day, there's a math problem. And the way that we have to address that math problem is multifaceted and won't all be done in this committee. But to be clear, one of the ways we do that is by valuing our most important work in the ways that we haven't done. What is the most important job? What are the most important jobs? They are our CNAs. They are our early childhood educators. They are our care professions, our nurses, our LPNs. That's the most important work. And it's important because it cares for people. And so if we don't value the most important work, then we aren't going to have people to do that work. And we have a math problem. And so continuing to talk about all of the different solutions is super important, and I want to do that. But I think we have to acknowledge that there is a numbers situation that we need to address. And to address that quickly is to value that work. And so I'm excited to see that it's been valued here and that it's being valued in other sectors as well. But we have to make it better work to care for our littlest Minnesotans and to care for our aging seniors than stocking shelves at Target. And until we make that market shift, we're going to continue to have a problem. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Yeah, Representative Hudson, I think we did have you. Yeah, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank all the members. I really appreciate, you know, we don't always have enough time to have this in-depth and a high level of conversation. And it's been very informative. And I appreciate the engagement with the point that I started off with regarding economics and economic theory. In response to Representative Coulter's point regarding regulation, price is a fantastic regulating instrument. And I'll give you an example that is adjacent to the work we do here in this committee. So there was an op-ed, I don't have it in front of me, from the Star Tribune a while back that was written by a former superintendent of Minneapolis schools. And in it, he was talking about the problem of literacy and citing the shocking fact that 60 to 70% of kids are not reading at grade level. And his focus of that op-ed was talking about the science of reading as opposed to another methodology, I think it's called whole language, that had been utilized for a number of years, and that there was this kind of internal ideological battle between which should be used and whole language had won out for a long time. And his case was that was a mistake, and we shouldn't have done that, and we need to pivot to talking about the science of reading and going back to kind of like a phonics-based approach. And he proposed we need to spend however many billions of dollars in order to do that. And the point that I thought that was missed in that op-ed is questioning a system that enabled and allowed the wrong approach to achieving its goal to persist chronically and systemically and with such a deleterious effect upon the people that it's meant to serve. That would not have happened, in my view, had parents been empowered with the ability to utilize the mechanism of price to regulate the services that are being provided to their children. And so what I hope, again, that we can take into consideration as we proceed with this work is providing opportunities, because what I see kind of hinted at in some of these recommendations is modeling this new department off of the existing Department of Education and having kind of a parallel or similar structure of thinking in terms of how to fund it. We're going to fund based on enrollment as opposed to attendance and that type of language. Well, that comes straight out of how we fund schools. So I think this is an opportunity for us to pause and reflect upon the successes and failures of our system to date and try not to replicate the failures and maybe even find a way that works that we can translate into K through 12 and beyond. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Yeah, I'm Lee Daniels, coming to you as usual to end things. I'd seen, Representative Daniels, I think you were looking at some sales tax exemptions relating to purchase of agricultural equipment. It was something that I had noticed and sort of made me think about sort of the idea that we do subsidize so many different things in our economy. And so I'm sort of thinking this is something that really may make a lot of sense. But Lee Daniels, please, your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Well, this has been a really robust, as my colleague said, discussion. Very good. Very good points. I appreciate that. We need to talk about all the issues, all the ideas, all the things that we're looking at, finances and people that are, you know, serving in nursing homes. I served on the aging committee in 2015 and 16, and the silver tsunami is here, you know. I'm thinking about retiring in a couple of years, so it's here. So I appreciate that. My colleagues have pointed that out very well. I don't really want to add to anything. I think the discussion has been very good. All the points I think have been made, and I'm just say my conservative voice would be, let's be careful with the money. It doesn't last forever, and some of the, you know, we've talked about in committee before, some of the price tags in some of these bills are astronomical, and before we go spending every dime we have, let's make sure we have a future, and don't jeopardize going into the deficit again like in 2012, I believe it was. So that's all my comments. I think everybody's made good valid points today.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. And I've really appreciated the conversation today as well. And yeah, anytime, I would love diving into economic theory and economics any chance I get. So I'm very happy to do that. And I will say, so this has been a great conversation. I guess full disclosure, I am very excited to move from conversation to action. We talk about the future. The current price to do some of these things may be high. The price for not doing them is significantly, significantly higher. And a lot of issues that we're dealing with today is because of the fact we haven't made these investments in the past. And we invest in education. This is education. It's education that has a bigger payoff, in fact, at least as big a payoff, I should say, as the education that we have made a public commitment to fund. So, you know, full disclosure, and I've been really clear about this all the way along in chairing the past committee as well. This is a public good that deserves public support. We want to make sure to do it in a smart way and to do it in a creative way. And that, to my mind, has been the work that the task force has done. So thank you so much for the presentation today, for all of your work. And members, on Thursday, we're going to consider a couple of proposals, I think, draw from some of the points from the task force, and we're going to keep on going from there. Representative Katisa Watoon, you got something real quick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just got an alert on my phone about our, is that tomorrow?
Just a reminder. You want me to do a reminder about that? Yeah, so 11 a.m. tomorrow, we're meeting with the Education Finance Committee, a joint hearing. I believe it's in this room. I could be wrong about that. No.
Capital
120. Capital 120. Okay, my apologies. In Capital 120. And so for those who can make it, I hope that you can. You may need to juggle other committees. Happy to connect with you about that. Yeah, thanks for that reminder, Representative Katisa Watoon. So that is the next hearing. Members, with that, we are adjourned. Thanks so much.